Welcome back to Monty and Reyes versus Movies Post-Apocalyptic. Thank you. That was the beautiful tones of Reyes's lovely, wonderful singing voice. Now I'm looking at her expectantly to describe who I am and how great I am.
Our announcer this evening will be the incomparable Monty Ashley.
Plug. We are, of course, part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. Hey, did you know that The Incomparable, the mothership show, the flagship of the whole podcast network, is having its 10th anniversary episode?
Did they even have the internet 10 years ago?
They did, and there was an episode of The Incomparable. Back then, they did not. This is a digression, but I think it's fun. Back then, they did not plan ahead. So, like, I think the third episode is science fiction novels. You know, all of them.
Well, you gotta start somewhere.
Let's just do all of Harry Potter. We space it out a bit more now.
Well, you were young. You had much more energy back then.
Oh, I wasn't on it back then. I didn't come on until episode 48.
Was it?
No, you were not. You have been on it, though. You were on that episode about, All About Eve, let's say? Or Sunset Boulevard?
Probably. Those are things I talk about a lot, so I've probably been on multiple podcasts where I talked to them. Can't shut me up.
Those are good movies, though. And I would venture to claim that 1990: The Bronx Warriors is not.
It is its own thing.
It's not its own thing. It's The Warriors plus Escape from New York minus, like, $5 million.
Okay. All right, you got me there. There are some festive street gangs.
All right, so this is a movie set in the far-off year of 1990. It was made in 1982, and we are told right up front that the police have abandoned the Bronx, and so now law and order is kept by the Riders, who are bad, bad motorcycle gangs.
Yes.
But I think we should address this right up front. There has not been an apocalypse in this movie.
No. I mean, the poster for the movie says it is post-apocalyptic.
Yes, it claims to be post-apocalyptic on the box. The box lies, which is, I think, fine for this genre.
Yeah,
but
this genre is full of lies.
There are a lot of shots in this one parking lot across a river from Manhattan, which I'm pretty sure means they're in Brooklyn or Queens, not the Bronx. And you can see Manhattan completely normal. School buses.
There are school buses going by over in Manhattan.
You can see the bridge to Manhattan, possibly the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't want to commit myself.
I think it could be the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a very stately bridge.
Yeah. And although at the beginning we see a young lady escaping through it on foot, that bridge is in use. Trucking is happening. There's even in the Bronx.
Because the Bronx has not been abandoned, what we're saying.
They cannot shut down roads. So usually, three blocks away from the action, there's clearly a fully functioning society.
Yes, and they really don't try to cover it up at all.
At all.
There are so many scenes where they're down in this one parking lot under the bridge because the bridge looks great as a background scene for all your bikers coming up. And you can just see cars and trucks going across the bridge like it's normal.
A lot of movies will purposely frame out the things that don't work. Like, if you're John Boorman, because I have Zardoz on the mind, and you're making Excalibur in your backyard, you make sure nobody has parked a pickup truck where the camera is pointing. This movie practically goes out of its way to show you how unapocalyptic this world is.
It's really sad. It's a step up from a homemade movie, and I say that because the lady that's the leading lady in this film is actually the director's daughter, because he, quote, couldn't find an actress that he wanted for the role.
And she does not get naked.
No, there's no boobs in this movie.
She does not get raped. She does get chained up for a really long time.
Yeah, but she's wearing like a long-sleeved high-button shirt at the time. So it's a very chaste chaining up.
And apparently she was the assistant director for a lot of shots.
Which might hopefully explain some of the shots were really good.
Yeah,
it had some neat cinematography here and there.
Yeah, this movie is shot in two places, New York City and Rome. And in their Rome shots, they have these cool ruins. and there's holes in the walls, and they do some really neat things with the camera sliding sideways and revealing something through a hole, or somebody walking into a hole, and there's his face. And we decided we wanted her to be responsible for those, because there's clearly somebody on staff who does good camera work.
Which, and we're hoping it's her, because yeah. That would be awesome.
I would say that was the best part of the movie, was those camera work shots.
Yeah, I would say, oh, look, there's that camera work again.
So, in the opening credits, which are mostly people with Italian names, we are told that stunts are done by Rocky's stuntmen team and the Hell's Angels. And that was exciting, because, you know, we have a vision, I at least have a vision in my mind of what the Hell's Angels are like. Huge bearded guys on Harleys is something you seem to expect.
Yeah, I expected them to be on Harleys. There were not a lot of Harleys in that movie.
There were Hondas.
There was the biker gangs were on Hondas. There were some Triumphs.
Yeah, you could tell which
guys. You could tell who were the actual bikers and who were the actors, is what I'm saying.
One way you could tell is that the actor is the one who fell down on his bike because he couldn't take a turn fast enough.
I mean, I don't think he got injured.
No.
But, yeah, it looked like a nasty fall.
Because he was on a pretty big bike, and he goes, like, up a curb and then on some grass. And you're thinking, that's not an off-road. Oh, no.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to it.
But they did leave it in the film because it's really the best stunt.
Yeah, it's a stunt. I'll leave that in. Oh, we're going to get to the fight scenes. But we got to hold off on that.
Oh, jeez, I forgot about the fight scenes.
Well, hold off.
Let's talk about the story a little bit.
The story. There's this woman who we learn is the heiress to the Manhattan Technology Company, or some equally dumb name.
Yes.
And that's the company that makes 90% of all the weapons in the world. So she's basically a princess on the run, but a corporate princess. She runs from Manhattan, where there is civilization, to the Bronx, where there is not. And then she is set upon by an evil street gang. And this is where the Warriors part kicks off, because the evil street gang are on roller skates and seem to have field hockey sticks.
Oh, you're right. They're like the Furies, but not quite.
Right. They're completely different. They have sticks at least. Well, the
they
Furies
do,
had
but
bats.
They're a hockey gang on roller skates.
Yeah, a roller hockey gang.
Yes. Whereas the Furies were a baseball team on roller skates.
Yes.
Completely different. No resemblance whatsoever.
Roller hockey makes more sense. I don't think.
Yeah.
Playing baseball on roller skates is a great idea.
You're always going to slide into every base.
Yeah. So they come up. What I wrote down was some ding-dongs on roller skates menace her. They do not use their sticks very effectively. And then a motorcycle gang shows up, and they have a fight with the field hockey team. And I guess we're already to the first fight scene. All the fights are terrible.
They are. Rocky's stunt team. Come on, guys. Who's Rocky?
It's been choreographed. And you can kind of, and sometimes more than kind of, see the actors thinking, all right, punch, duck, dodge, I'm getting hit now.
Yes. Yeah. You can see them thinking through it. So the leader of the biker gang, and remember, the bikers are the law enforcement.
Yeah, the leader of the biker gang, presumably one of the baddest dudes, we're told he is one of the top three baddest dudes in New York.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Trash. How would you describe Trash's whole deal?
Trash has the kind of wavy hair you would expect of John Bon Jovi in the late 80s.
Absolutely. He has great hair.
He is very fit. He's like a bodybuilder kind of guy.
He's exactly a bodybuilder kind of guy.
That's because they cast him because someone saw him in a gym.
Yeah, he's not an actor kind of guy.
He's wearing a leather vest.
He's wearing a leather vest with straps and buckles to keep it very tight in the waist.
Well, yeah, you want make your chest look bigger.
His chest looks very big.
Yes, he has the largest breasts of anyone.
And he is not a good actor.
No, bless his little heart.
And at no point do you buy him as anything.
Aw, he was only 18 when he got the role.
Yeah,
but yeah, I read on the IMDb trivia that that he was auditioning against 2,000 other men and got this lead. There is no way 2,000 people auditioned for the movie.
He's got a henchman named Ice, who is the smart biker because he wears glasses, and he's the one who fell off his bike.
Yeah.
And so they save her, and now she's kind of part of the gang almost immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they go down to this one parking lot with a great view of Manhattan.
Doesn't she end up with her own motorcycle?
Like, eventually,
in the beginning of the movie?
Not right away, but after a bit. So they go down to this parking lot. And here's my favorite part of the movie. There's a dude doing a drum solo.
Just
for no reason, for this entire scene. And it wasn't scripted. They just, when they got to their location,
there was just
a band.
There was a band practicing because it's the middle of nowhere, and who would possibly stumble upon them?
So, just...
It's a dirt parking lot. It's not, like, paved or anything.
Yeah.
So don't get any visions that this is some highfalutin parking lot with parking spaces. No, it's just dirt and grass.
Yeah. But for this entire scene that goes on for a long time, they just sometimes cut over, and there's this guy... And it's such a weird choice that I really liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too. I thought it added something, and this movie definitely needs some things added where they can get it.
So the bikers pull up, and they find a guy who's been impaled on a thing.
Oh, that's right. He was
he
was an informer.
An informer. We later learned that this guy had a gizmo. They always call it a gizmo. It's kind of a tracking thing, a huge watch. That he was letting the cops know what was going on.
They use the word gizmo a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
More than in Gremlins, where there's actually a character named Gizmo.
She just made me high-five her.
Ah!
So then another gang shows up. These guys are all standing on the running boards of these big 1940s-style cars. They're on the running boards, because why would you have running boards if you don't have people on them?
Right, and they're...
And they are dressed like pimps, 1970s pimps, and they are led by Fred Williamson, who is great.
Yeah, why is Fred Williamson in this movie? Now, Fred Williamson didn't actually film any scenes in New York. He was in Rome the whole time.
Yeah, so when they go to talk to him in this scene, they have to kind of stick their head into a car.
And then you see him sitting in the car delivering his lines, and he's delivering them very well.
Yeah, Fred Williamson knows how to be in this kind of movie, and while he's in it, he kind of elevates it.
He does.
All right. So we get the story that the girl has run away, and then we check in on what's happening in Manhattan. And what's happening in Manhattan is, where did she go? So they have to get Hammer.
Oh, that's right. Her father is like, send in the Hammer.
Yeah. And it's like a half hour before we see the Hammer, which is weird because it's a 93-minute movie.
It certainly felt longer.
Wow. Yeah. Like, I don't know if I can go through this plot point by plot point. I took good notes.
You did. I took no notes.
Yeah. So the Hammer shows up and shoots a couple people and then vanishes somehow.
Right. The Hammer is played by Vic Morrow.
Yeah, okay.
He filmed this right before the Twilight Zone movie. So he died filming Twilight Zone before this ever was released, and I think that was kind of a mercy.
Yeah. Oh,
he never got to see this in the theater.
But it also means somebody else had to dub his voice, and along with Fred Williamson, Vic Morrow is the other actual actor in the movie.
Yeah.
And I really think, him growling about why he's doing this, and I'm from the Bronx, you're ashamed of that, you don't want anyone to know. No, I want everybody to know. I don't want anyone to ever forget I'm from the Bronx. Shoot, 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 shoot.
That's actual dialogue from the movie.
Yeah.
So anyway, they bring the Hammer in, and then we don't see him for a long time. They just say, we're sending him in.
Yeah.
And then we cut back to the motorcycle gang and the girl. Fred Williamson is the king of New York, I think.
No, that's a whole different movie. Fred Williamson is Ogre.
Oh, that's right.
The Bronx is very territorial. There are scavengers who control this one tunnel area, which is clearly shot in Rome, and they kind of fulfill the role of troglodytes. I did not know troglodytes were so common in post-apocalyptic movies.
I didn't either, but these are definitely some Morlock-looking dudes.
Yeah. And, all right, there's a moment when Ice has an argument with a truck driver with one leg.
Oh, yeah, that truck driver with one leg.
He's kind of fun.
He shows up for a while and hangs out with Ice and Hammer. Or hangs out with Hammer.
Yeah,
I think.
He's with Hammer. He is known to be a stooge or something. And what I liked about him was there were a chase scene or two where four motorcycles are chasing this semi, but they have to go real slow because it's just these like four blocks that look...
Because they only have a couple blocks to shoot in before they get out into real traffic.
Yeah.
And the motorcycles are going so slow, I'm worried they will fall over.
They run the truck off the road. It is not easy for a motorcycle to run a semi off the road. He doesn't have a trailer, but even so.
And the road, when we say off the road, we mean kind of against the side of the alley they're filming in. Yeah, it's not a real road.
Eventually, she gets kidnapped by, I'm going to say, the worst gang. They're the dancers.
Oh, no. The dancers are, do the dancers take her? They've got that. Okay. Well, she gets kidnapped by a gang who I believe are dancers. And they take them to her lair, to their lair, which looks like a lot of fun. It's got tire swings.
Okay, you're right. The tire swing gang, although they have dancers in it, we see them practicing their tumbling, and they are definitely wearing leotards.
Oh, so many leotards.
They're not the dance gang. And I do want to talk about the dance gang. As the dance gang didn't have her, it's just that our boys need to travel through the dance gang territory.
Right, and they have to make peace with the dance gang, yeah, which is led by an African-American woman dressed like Columbia from the Rocky, yeah, Horror Picture Show. She's got the gold bowler hat.
A Columbia, of course, a top hat with sequins. This is more of a spray-painted gold bowler hat, and it has, like, rivets kind of fake onto it.
Yeah, and we all know what those are. Yeah. Those are googly eyes that are, yes, spray-painted over with gold paint.
And this is easily the worst fight scene, where the movie does not wink at it, but these big, burly bikers get beat up by sylph-like dancers.
Who all move in unison.
Yeah. And they look kind of like mimes. And
there's a little miming going on. It is.
They look like they should be in Godspell. And listen, they just don't look that intimidating.
But no, and you know, a dancer can kick your head off.
Oh, yeah.
But
they're very limber.
These guys don't look very dancer-y.
They're not the kind of dancer that does the lifts. They're the kind of dancer that gets lifted.
Yes.
The movie treats them as total threats, which I appreciated. Like,
they all have little canes.
They do all have little canes. But, you know, they do their thing, and eventually they say, all right, you can pass through. And I want to believe that this is whatever Rocky's stuntmen team. But you're right. She's actually being held captive by the roller hockey people, who have an amazing workout studio with a trampoline.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is the roller hockey team that eventually kidnap her.
Although,
they take her to their studio. They have a trampoline in the background.
They have three guys in leotards and boxing gloves, and we do not get a real good look at them, but they are hilarious.
They chain her up, more or less.
Yeah, it's one of those things where her arms are straight out to the side and dangling from chains, and it looks uncomfortable, but they are not menacing her at all. It's like,
no, she's just kind of standing around waiting for something to happen.
They did not have, just like the audience, they did not have a place to stash her. So this all happens, and it's about as coherent as we're making it sound, I think.
I think we're making it sound much more coherent than it actually is, quite frankly.
So Trash decides he needs to get to Ogre. Trash and Ogre, that's the long-haired kid with huge pectoral muscles, and Fred Williamson.
Yes.
They are the two toughest guys in New York. They're going to team up, but he's got to convince Ogre to team up with him.
So he must go to Ogre's
lair. And Ogre has a great lair. Fred Williamson knows how to live. He's got people arrayed aesthetically. He's got somebody playing a solid white grand piano.
Yes, he has also some jazz musicians later show up.
He's got a throne.
He's got some zebra skins and some lion skins thrown around. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And there's this big hole in the ceiling that I think is near his headquarters. People are constantly showing up in that hole, looking down and shouting things.
Right. It's supposed to be in his it's like the entrance to his lair. There's a hole in the roof.
Yeah. And it goes to the scavenger people. It does. It definitely does. She's looking at me suspiciously.
I don't believe that's true.
Well, it goes towards the scavenger people because that's where Trash and his guys go through the scavenger people and then get to that hole.
Okay.
And they come down and say, Ogre, join up. And I think he says, yeah, okay.
They have to convince him. Then there's some shooting.
Yeah, at this point, Hammer is back and he's looking for them and he's just shooting the heck out of everybody he can find. He's furious.
Yeah, I don't know why they call him Hammer. They should call him Gun.
Ah, that's good. I know why they call Trash Trash.
Ha! You leave that poor sweet boy alone. He's just a child.
All right, I'm going to read some of my recap here that I wrote. Hammer convinces Ogre to go with him to get his girl back. Ogre's whip-wielding girl comes with them, and I am 1,000,000% convinced that she's why those women in Double Dragon have whips. Ogre.
Oh yeah, that's right, I forgot. The witch.
Yeah, Ogre has a lady named the witch, and she's got like a ball gown with a cape, and she uses a bullwhip.
Yeah.
And
I liked her.
Eventually, Hammer gets tired of sneaking around and sends in the troops, which is 5 horses and some people on them, and also a helicopter. We see many shots while they're shooting in New York in which 5 policemen on horses ride past the screen, and then we pan up to see the helicopter. They are definitely getting their money's worth out of those shots.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot of that shot because we paid people to bring horses in, damn it.
And then in Rome, there are these shots where she whips a guy around the neck and pulls him off the horse, and now he's dead or something.
Right. Like you are.
And there's several fights. Just a bunch of scavengers jump out at Fred Williamson, who's all alone. Oh, but he kills them. And then I think the same scavengers jump out at the witch, and she kills them. And then the same scavengers jump out at Trash, and he is useless. And Fred Williamson comes in and kills them.
And saves Trash, yeah.
He's very much more convincing, is Fred Williamson.
Yes.
The horse-riding cops, I should mention, have flamethrowers. And there are a lot of shots of people being burned alive.
And also, I worry about those horses.
Oh, the horses could not have been.
Could not have enjoyed having flamethrowers shot over their heads.
I think they also did not like being thrown to the ground constantly.
Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah.
Let's see, Ogre has a sword cane, which we know because he is constantly whipping the sword out of the cane dramatically and then having to put it back in so he can do it again a few minutes later.
Right.
I loved it. That's what I would be doing if I had a sword cane. There's no point in having it if you can't dramatically reveal it.
That's why you don't have a sword cane.
That's the problem, all right.
Yep.
Eventually, Hammer gets shot, and he has a cigar on his throne. The girl from Manhattan, whose name I never got, and I was
looking
real hard.
We were never told that girl's name. She's just the princess.
She gets shot saving Trash, but it's after she has inherited the company and made him part of the board of directors, but not told anyone in Manhattan that it happened.
Yeah.
But I think if I...
I'm going to put you on the board of directors. And then she gets shot by Hammer, who's trying to kill Trash.
Yeah. So now Hammer is standing up above this big hole in the ceiling. He shouts that he's Hammer of God. And he has been shouting and laughing for like 10 minutes because they did not give him anything.
He just starts laughing and shouting randomly at some point in the movie. And he just continues until...
And now, because it's the end of the movie, Trash finds a harpoon.
Oh, yeah.
Because
there's just always a harpoon lying around.
While Hammer is standing there watching him and laughing, Trash takes his harpoon, points at him, shoots him. It hits him in the torso. It looks like it goes in about a quarter of an inch because we can still see the entire harpoon.
Yeah.
And then Hammer falls through that one hole. And then Trash ties him behind his bike, drags him, and that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's just a real incoherent mess of a movie that's not post-apocalyptic at all.
I felt we were lied to.
There were no shoulder pads. There were some cool spiked elbow pads.
Well, there was that one gang that had those things that looked kind of like sleeping bag shoulder pads.
Yeah, like there's this, that's the roller hockey
gang. The roller hockey.
They have things on their shoulders that it looks kind of like they folded a quilt into a triangle.
Yeah. It's important to be comfy.
It's about as shoulder paddy as what Riff and Magenta are wearing right at the end of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes.
Which is to say, a little. So what did you think of 1990: The Bronx Warriors?
Well, I found it weirdly enjoyable.
Oh,
I liked it a lot more than some of the other movies we've watched.
I enjoyed it a great deal. It is, as they say in the Flophouse, it's a good bad movie.
It is. It's fun.
You're constantly saying, what are they doing? Is this a funeral pyre?
It is shockingly rape-free.
It's really badly done, but because it's reliant so much on movies you've already seen, I cannot emphasize enough how much this is Escape from New York plus The Warriors.
Yes.
That.
But not really enough of either of them to make it interesting.
So you can always tell what's going on just based on what's happening, what would happen in a real movie. And then sometimes it gets really, really weird, like that drum solo. Which
there was just a guy there, and he was playing drums, and they're like, hey, let's put him in the movie.
Yeah.
Good for you, drummer.
You know how in some movies, like do the right thing. There'll be a radio DJ describing the action that kind of serves as a narrator. That's what the drummer felt like he was going to be to me.
Yeah.
Like he was just going to score the whole movie live on stage, which would be amazing.
That would have been great. But no, he's just hanging out.
He's just there for that scene and then gone.
Never hear from him again. Probably died in the apocalypse.
Yeah, the apocalypse. I'm so mad about how unapocalyptic this was. But there's clearly a working city.
Right next door. And in this shot, like, during the chase scene with the truck, there's a cross street, like, two blocks down that's just full of regular traffic.
Yeah.
I found it absolutely delightful.
Yeah, it is what I wanted. To be clear, this is exactly what I wanted to see when we said, let's watch post-apocalyptic movies all year. I wanted really bad copies of good movies.
Right, and this is one of the enjoyable copies of good movies.
It's
Wheels of Fire was not enjoyable. This one is enjoyable.
This one, I enjoyed it. But I think it's time to find out what we watch next.
Oh, Monty, it's your turn to draw from the magical box.
I'm drawing from the magical box.
The magical box has a skull on it.
Yeah. So, you know. Here we go. Our next movie is going to be The Postman.
Oh my God, that is so topical.
It's very topical. It's about a mailman who saves civilization. Here's another fun fact. It is twice as long as 1990 The Bronx Warriors. This is a 3-hour movie.
Oh my God, you're going to make me deal with the postal service for 3 hours?
Oh, there's no postal service. It's just the postman. I have seen this movie before.
It's true. I have heard that the book was interesting.
And I will tell you the two things I remember about the movie The Postman, before we rewatch it.
Okay.
One, I think Kevin Costner's coat is great.
Yes.
I'm really into a piece of wardrobe from this thing. And two, Tom Petty plays himself.
Sure. Has there been an apocalypse?
Oh, yes, 100%. There's been an apocalypse in The Postman.
That's what I'm looking for.
All right. That was 1990, The Bronx Warriors. We're going to switch it up for a high-minded, artistic piece that did not end Kevin Costner's career. See you then.